I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic is dead, assassinated in Belgrade this morning. The 50-year-old Djindjic was a pro-West reformer who helped topple former President Slobodan Milosevic 3 years ago, turning him over to an international war crimes court and paving the way for the new nation of Serbia and Montenegro. Here to put the death in Belgrade in perspective is former Ambassador Richard Holbrook, who brokered the 1995 Dayton Peace Accords that ended the Bosnian War. And he joins us on the line from Geneva. Good afternoon, Ambassador.
Good afternoon, Robin.
Your first thoughts?
Well, Zoran Djindjic was a wonderful man. I knew him well. I worked with him when he was in the opposition, trying to overthrow Milosevic and bring democracy to Serbia. And it's a tremendous loss for the democratic forces in the region. I'm really heartbroken about it.
Well, we have memories of 3 years ago of the protests, the parliament burning, and Milosevic being turned over for trial. Place Zoran Djindjic there. What was his role?
Djindjic was one of the two or three key organizers of all the demonstrations beginning in 1996 when he marched through the streets of Belgrade in an unsuccessful attempt to forge a unified opposition to the 2000 effort, which did succeed. He and Kostunica forged a common alliance, although they didn't like each other. Kostunica became president of Yugoslavia, and Djindjic became prime minister of Serbia. Two different jobs within that weird structure that was just dismantled about a month ago.
Right.
And during that whole period, Djindjic was a visionary who really believed in democracy and was trying to stamp out corruption in a country which, during the Milosevic era, had fallen into the hands of organized criminals. I don't know who killed him, but it's not impossible that it was organized criminals because he was going after them.
And there was another attempt on his life
Yes.
just recently. He said at Yes. that time it was a futile effort that could not stop democratic reforms.
Well, I hope he proves to be right. He was the leader of those forces. And he was a genuine post-nationalist leader for the Balkans, trying to move his people beyond the narrow and extreme nationalism which had caused so many wars in the last 10 years.
He was also someone known for his fondness for big cars and flashy suits, and some would say arrogant manner.
He wasn't arrogant.
Well, some would say.
He was a very courageous man. Maybe he liked big cars. I didn't know that was a serious defect in a person.
I would say, though, that his foes thought that he was somewhat authoritarian. And when you mentioned that perhaps it was a criminal element that had assassinated him, was there anyone else who would have wanted him out of power?
Well, look, he was the key figure in getting Milosevic to The Hague. And if it weren't for him, Milosevic would not be in The Hague today.
What does happen now, do you think?
I don't know. You know, only in the last few weeks has the name Yugoslavia disappeared from the maps of the world, and this new, oddly named country of Serbia and Montenegro has been created. So this may set off another wave of chaos, or it might not.
In the meantime, it is, as you said, a tremendous loss.
Oh, it's a tremendous loss. He was one of the finest people in a part of the world where there were very few good, brave, and pro-democracy people.
Richard Holbrook, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Former Ambassador Richard Holbrook, he spoke to us from Geneva.
An intense session this morning during question time in the British Parliament, where parliamentarians again, but perhaps more fiercely than ever, demanded answers from Prime Minister Tony Blair about his position on Iraq. As for Blair's position as Prime Minister, well, he's now facing so much opposition from within his own party that there's even talk he could be driven from office or resign. Joining us on the line from London is WBUR's Michael Goldfarb. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Bill.
Michael, how did the Prime Minister do in Parliament this morning?
Well, after a brutal 72 hours, the place was packed, and he did extremely well. He's very good at these sessions. He's done nothing, it seems, in the last 2 weeks except address groups of people who are skeptical. But these are people who are skeptical, and he knows them very well because he meets with them once a week in question time. And he beat back most questions. I mean, the most severe questioning, of course, came from his own Labour Party backbenchers, most of whom now have broken cover. It's very clear they don't want a war, certainly not without a second UN resolution. And, you know, his task today wasn't made any easier by, you know, the comments yesterday of U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld during his press conference when he said, oh, well, the U.S. can go it alone if Britain can't join them.
Yeah, that kind of, after all the prime minister has done in supporting the U.S. position, that made it seem like the U.S. could just dismiss him if he didn't do what the U.S. wanted him to do.
Over here, it must be said that at Downing Street, they were, it's reported, absolutely furious by that comment. It really makes Tony Blair's position all the more difficult.
Yeah, well, as you say, though, he held his own in Parliament this morning. Let's listen for a moment as the Prime Minister addresses a question from the Leader of the Opposition, Ian Duncan Smith, about a possible second resolution at the UN and the possibility of the U.S. going it alone.
The reason why I believe it is important that we hold firm to the course that we have set out is because what is at stake here is not whether the United States goes alone or not. It is whether the international community is prepared to back up the clear instruction that it gave to Saddam Hussein with the necessary action. That is why I am determined that we hold firm to the course we have set out.
He sounded in control, in command, but how much trouble is he in, Michael? I mean, there's talk of resignation. He still has a nice fat majority in Parliament, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the resignation talk, I think, is several steps down the road. I mean, if the UN doesn't yield a second resolution, and if there's a decision for war anyway, and if the war bogs down, I think that he would have no other option but to resign, because this is a country where resignation happens. But the more immediate problem for him is that, you know, he isn't elected prime minister. He is simply a humble member of parliament, and as the leader of the Labour Party, is appointed prime minister to form a government. And it is not out of the realms of possibility that if this situation at the UN really bogs down and he has to break promises to his parliamentary Labour Party colleagues, that they would select someone, they would tap someone to challenge him to be leader. I mean, this is what happened to Margaret Thatcher when she was essentially deposed by her own Conservative Party. They looked at her, saw she was an electoral liability, organized a leadership challenge, and she was forced to resign because she couldn't win a clear first ballot victory. This scenario, this kind of scenario, isn't outside the realms of possibility.
Michael, I gather the Prime Minister was also asked about an announcement yesterday in Washington that five U.S. companies, including Halliburton, where, of course, Vice President Dick Cheney was the CEO, these companies were being invited to bid for business in a post-war Iraq, but no British firms were invited.
Yes, that was the one question in the half hour at Prime Minister's Questions today that had him flustered. He was asked that by a man named Vincent Cable, who's a liberal Democrat and also a senior executive in the oil business. And he said, well, I don't agree with your question in some way. I mean, he was really flustered by that one. You know, he hasn't had much help from the U.S. between Donald Rumsfeld's comments and yesterday's announcement that no British firms would be invited to, you know, bid for contracting work in post-war Iraq. It just doesn't make his job any easier.
Michael Goldfarb, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Bill.
Here and Now's Michael Goldfarb is also a correspondent for NPR member station WBUR's documentary unit Inside Out. He joined us from London.
Sandbags and foxholes are beginning to appear on the streets of Baghdad. Joining us now for a picture postcard of a city waiting for war is David Filipov of the Boston Globe. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. David, tell me, are you standing outside right now?
I am standing outside on a very busy street in a sandstorm, what it looks like.
In Baghdad. What do you see?
I'm actually looking over at the Rafidine Bank, which is closed right now. It's a very busy city street. This city never looks like a place that's preparing for war. It's dark now, but earlier in the day there was construction work going on right here at the Ministry of Information where I am. They're building new offices to accommodate the press here, the Ministry of Information being one of the likely targets of any U.S. attacks. You see a lot of foxholes being dug and sandbags. So there is some preparation going on.
You painted a sort of a comical picture of these military drills of, as you said, policemen trying to ride on their motorcycles and hold AK-47s. Is that just for some sort of show?
Well, the government here is trying to mobilize people and trying to rally people, get them ready. After the Gulf War, 1991, there were uprisings around the country, and obviously the government is concerned about what might happen. So one of the efforts here is to keep everybody rallied and also to give the impression to the people here and to the world that Iraq is preparing and that it's ready. Unfortunately, because in a lot of ways it really isn't ready, some of those efforts come off kind of comical. I mean, when the fire trucks drive around with firemen all armed with AK-47s, those people are trained to put out fires, not to drive in their big red fire trucks and start shooting.
Is it having a rallying effect or a nerve-rattling effect?
That's a good question. In public, of course, everyone would say they believe in the leadership and they put their faith in God and whatever is their destiny, they're ready for it. In private, it's very guarded private conversations, which are very dangerous. People voice some of their anxieties. About what might happen, whether they'll, the government will lose control, there'll be street fighting. People are, of course, worried about the bombs, whether, something missed target and hit them, hit their home, hit their family. People have a lot of anxiety and a lot of concern. Mm.
You've had some of those private and it sounds like dangerous conversations, and you've seen the sort of, as you write, the juxtaposition of war and normalcy. Just tell us briefly before you go about a young man you met in a CD store.
Yeah, there's one particular place in Baghdad where there are a number of stores where people sell movies and videos, and I ran into some cool-looking kids who were pretty fly for Iraqi guys, and they're like Limp Bizkit, George Michael, and what was the other one? Eminem. There's a station here. There's one station that plays a playlist that's fairly eclectic, and they'll go from a Limp Bizkit song or into the Clash and to some mellow sort of top 40, Mariah Carey, something like that. And so these guys, that's what they hear, and so that's what they like. Everybody speaks some English, and so they're very happy to see an American so they could chat about their favorite musicians, George Michael and Eminem.
Well, that sound, that American pop sound mixes with the minarets that, as you write, boom with sermons calling on the Iraqis to die, fighting the infidel. David Filipov, thank you.
Thank you.
David Filipov reports for the Boston Globe. He spoke to us from Baghdad.
Just ahead, a visit to the Longfellow House in Cambridge, Massachusetts, part of our exploration of The Dante Club, the bestseller that imagines Longfellow and friends solving a murder mystery that mimics Dante's Inferno.
And later, another U.S. diplomat resigns over the Bush administration's Iraq policy. We'll speak with him.
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Power plays at the United Nations, where impassioned debate continues as the deadline for war with Iraq takes shape. For more, go to WBUR.org and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Goldsmiths 3 of Concord, creative contemporary jewelers handcrafting rings and other fine jewelry for engagements, weddings, anniversaries, and all days made special. For the complete picture, Goldsmiths3.com. And the Citizens Bank 123 Home Refinancing Program, helping people refinance their homes with less paperwork and today's current market interest rates. Information available at 1-800-340-LOAN. A banker will provide the details. Citizens Bank, not your typical bank, an equal housing lender. It's 1221. Look for highs in the lower 50s this afternoon, ahead of 1 to 3 inches of snow tomorrow.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
We recently paid a visit to 105 Brattle Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts, former home to American poet and scholar Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and the scene of both a real and fictionalized club, the Dante Club. That's also the name of a new bestseller by our tour guide, Matthew Pearl. In the book, Matthew imagines the real-life poets meeting every Wednesday night to translate Dante's Divine Comedy, while also trying to solve a gruesome string of Boston murders.
Probably I think we should start in the parlor.
It's so funny. I feel like we're about to play Clue.
Yeah, the parlor, right.
But with long cough.
Everything in the house is exactly the way it was in the fall of 1865. The home was a wedding gift to Longfellow and his bride, and you can feel the family presence still.
It was actually the family that was at the heart of why Longfellow turned to Dante. After his wife had an extremely sudden and tragic death by fire, it's really a heartbreaking story. She was cutting the hair of two of her little girls, and it was a stifling hot summer day, and she was sealing the hair with hot wax, and somehow a flake of that fell on her light summer dress, and just she caught completely on fire, and Longfellow hugged her to the ground. He put out the fire in the process, burning his face. And that's why he grew this beard, that we all think of him having this Homeric beard as part of his sort of quaint, you know, archaic image. But in fact, it was because he could never shave again from this moment of a remarkable, you know, loss.
It's such a horrendous story. And suddenly things are falling into place,
right?
Because he had such remarkably, as some would say, optimistic, cheery poetry. And then suddenly he goes to Dante.
Right, and that really was the trigger for that. Longfellow couldn't find in himself the strength to do his own poetry anymore. It was really at that point that he began to translate Dante. And this was the first time an American would translate the entire poem, the entire Divine Comedy. And this was something that began really in solitude. But around him rallied the Dante Club, this group of poets, his friends, and they would come here into the front hall. They would enter the front hall every Wednesday evening.
Right where we are.
They might ring the bell around 7 or 7:30. They would start to arrive on a Wednesday evening. Often Longfellow would see them coming from his window and would greet them at the door even before they got here.
Where should we go from here?
The study is actually where the Dante Club met every Wednesday evening. Longfellow would look at that clock, and he would call out school time, and everyone would fall quiet, and they would take their seats. This is where they sat, at this very table, and this might have been one of the Dante books they looked at. And one of the highest objects in the room that we're looking at is a sculpture of Dante. And this casket, it was said, contained fragments of Dante's tomb. So there's really almost a religious relic of Dante as they're going through this process of reviving Dante, of bringing Dante to life.
And let's talk about your book for a second. Longfellow and his Dante's Club are they're helping him do his interpretation of the Divine Comedy.
Exactly.
At the same time, an extraordinary murder spree is taking place throughout
right,
the city.
Right.
How did this come to you?
Well, I think part of it was that their story is actually dramatic, more dramatic than you would think. The actual history of doing this translation was a history that involved going up against an establishment and having to do this activity that was actually considered dangerous, because it was a question of poets having to confront the reality of violence, which is what Dante did. Dante wrote a story about himself, a poet, having to travel through hell and witness this horror, this terror. So it's a sense that in order to create our literature, in order to create American literature, we had to confront the reality of violence that in post-Civil War America was new. It was sudden.
So Dante and Virgil in the Divine Comedy, they travel through the layers of hell. Matthew has Longfellow and his club then descend through their own hell as they try to find out who the murderer is in Boston. How did you ever? You have your first poor victim right as the story opens, is the poor thing set upon by maggots. What does that represent? What is that? Is that real?
Well, we think of maggots as feeding on dead tissue. That's why we find them on dead bodies. And when we do, we can trace how long that body has been dead by counting the maggots and the size of the maggots. But at one point, there actually existed a species of maggot that fed on living tissue. And this was problematic because livestock would get a wound and these maggots would infiltrate and essentially eat them out from the inside. And sometimes it happened to people. I'm not an entomologist, and all of this was new to me, and it's about research, and that's really, with historical fiction, research is as important as writing.
We don't want to give away the ending, I mean, because it is a little bit, you know, it is a murder mystery,
right. In fact,
but we can talk about the real ending, you know, for Longfellow. Did Dante help him recover from his wife's death?
Absolutely. I remember Dante, the first lines of Dante's poem, midway through the journey of our life, Dante finds himself lost in the dark woods because the right path had been lost. It's a crisis in the middle of his life, and Longfellow came to the same point in his life, and it was Dante that guided him through it. And not just as a poet. As a poet, Dante allowed Longfellow to undergo this amazing project where he could share a voice with Dante. His own voice might have been too painful for him at the time. His own confrontation with the loss of his wife. But to share a voice with Dante, it allowed him to continue as a poet, to grow as a poet, and also to reunite with his friends. From solitude to friendship, his Dante Club allowed him to have society again. It allowed him to have communion again.
Well, Matthew Pearl, thank you so much for bringing these real-life characters to life, Longfellow and his club, and for killing the fictional ones in such a phenomenal way.
Oh, well, thank you, Robin. It was so much fun to be able to walk through the house and talk about it with you.
Matthew Pearl is author of the new book, The Dante Club, a novel. For more information about the book or about the Longfellow House, a national historic site in Cambridge, Massachusetts, check out our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the latest diplomatic tweaking on a UN resolution regarding Iraq.
And our listener poetry challenge. Hundreds of you put your feelings about war into verse. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Fresh Air at 1 o'clock, the current state of the Israel-Palestine crisis and the impact a war with Iraq might have on that situation. We'll hear from James Bennett, who's Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Jordan's Furniture, furnishing houses and creating homes and families in partnership with Massachusetts Adoption Resource Exchange. Information at 617-54-ADOPT. Studio 180, integrating design and technology to deliver strategically focused websites on the web at studio180.com. And Portland Pottery Supply, offering a full line of pottery materials, equipment and supplies for schools, hobbyists, and professionals. Now located in Braintree, PortlandPottery.com. Now's your chance to make a contribution for the news that will enter your name in a drawing to win a brand new Apple iBook laptop computer courtesy of Tech Superpowers. Enter the drawing with your $100 contribution for the news before Friday's deadline at WBUR.org.
This is Bob Oakes. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, the latest on Iraq and the push to set a final deadline for disarmament. Also, the third report in our series on homework. And House Speaker Thomas Finneran talks about the state budget with business leaders in Boston. Those stories and the rest of the news tomorrow on Morning Edition, starting at 5, here on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, 22 years in the State Department, but now John Brown's resigned over the war in Iraq.
I have never seen in my 20 years in the Foreign Service a case so badly made to take this kind of massive force in the situation that we're talking about.
Also, environmentalists battle the U.S. military over land use rights on 30 million acres of military land.
These stories, plus a history of baking in America and the international flap over the French in French fries, coming up Here and Now.
I'm Ted O'Brien. Britain is trying to set out disarmament conditions that it hopes the UN will embrace in considering a new resolution against Iraq. British Prime Minister Tony Blair has drawn up a list of six conditions that Saddam Hussein should meet to avoid war, including a television appearance by the Iraqi leader admitting he's concealed weapons and pledging to disarm, as well as a commitment to allow Iraqi scientists to be interviewed outside Iraq. Blair is looking to break the impasse on the Security Council.
What we are looking at is whether we can set out a very clear set of tests for Iraq to meet in order to demonstrate that it is in full compliance. For example, based on what the inspectors have already found, the anthrax, the thousands of liters unaccounted for, either produce it or produce the documentation showing it is destroyed.
Questions still remain over how long Saddam Hussein would be given to prove that he has disarmed. The White House says no more than 10 days or so, but some countries are suggesting as many as 45. The president is sending his condolences to the people of Serbia in the aftermath of this morning's assassination of Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic. The prime minister was shot in Belgrade in front of a government complex and died at a hospital shortly thereafter. White House officials say Djindjic will be remembered for his help in bringing Yugoslavian leader Slobodan Milosevic to justice and bringing democracy to Serbia. Pakistani officials are denying an Iranian report that Osama bin Laden has been captured. An Islamic leader in Pakistan was quoted on Iran radio as saying bin Laden was arrested, claiming officials weren't going to announce the arrest until a war with Iraq began. CIA says it's not aware that bin Laden's been captured. Army officials say 11 of the 13 soldiers aboard a Black Hawk helicopter that crashed yesterday have died. Two survivors have been hospitalized. Officials say the initial investigation so far finds no evidence of problems prior to the crash near the Fort Drum area in New York. Army investigators say heavy snow in the area is making their work more difficult. Police in Miami have evacuated a high-rise bank building after two burglars drew guns on a security guard. Police searched the building but did not find the burglars, who are believed to still be hiding inside the building. There is no evidence that anyone is being held hostage at this moment. Checking the numbers on Wall Street, the Dow is down 83 points at 7,441. The Nasdaq is off 15 at 1,256. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Jordan's Furniture, furnishing houses and creating homes and families in partnership with Massachusetts Adoption Resource Exchange. Information at 617-54-ADOPT. And Studio 180, integrating design and technology to deliver strategically focused websites on the web at studio180.com. And Portland Pottery Supply, offering a full line of pottery materials, equipment, and supplies for schools, hobbyists, and professionals, now located in Braintree, portlandpottery.com. Forecast revised, partly sunny this afternoon, then becoming mostly cloudy, chance of a shower late, but highs of 50 to 55 degrees. Then tonight will be mostly cloudy with lows near 30, and then tomorrow back into winter for a brief period. Cloudy with snow likely from late morning through the afternoon and accumulations of 1 to 3 inches, highs in the lower 30s. Friday, increasing clouds, upper 30s, 40s and 50s on the weekend.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A second senior U.S. diplomat has now resigned, saying that the United States under President Bush risks becoming associated with the unjustified use of force. Until this week, John Brown was a diplomat in residence at Georgetown University. In the course of his 22-year Foreign Service career, he served in London, Prague, Krakow, Kiev, Belgrade, and Moscow. The move follows the resignation earlier this month of John Brady Kiesling, a State Department official in Athens. In his letter of resignation sent to Secretary of State Colin Powell, John Brown says that the president's disregard for views in other nations is giving birth to an anti-American century. Mr. Brown now joins us on the phone. Hello, John.
Bill, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for joining us. Why are you resigning?
Well, there are many reasons, but the two main ones are that, first, I simply think that the president has failed to present a convincing case to Americans and to the world that massive force should be used against Iraq at this time. And secondly, I felt I had to speak out and share my views with my fellow citizens as a Foreign Service officer, having lived abroad and seen other countries where we don't have the freedom that we have here. I was felt that I did have to speak out and express my opinion.
But, John, more than two decades in the Foreign Service, you must have at times encountered American policy that you found hard to swallow. But was it not your brief to carry out that policy?
Well, Bill, that's a very good question. But I have never seen in my 20 years in the Foreign Service a case so badly made to take this kind of massive force in the situation that we're talking about. And I don't think the president has made the case. And never in my Foreign Service career, I've never seen a case so badly made.
What would you do about Saddam Hussein?
What would I do? At this point, I would not rush into things. I would listen to world opinion and consider time. Time is important, not to rush into war.
Why should we give a man more time who has already been asked to disarm some 17 times by the United Nations and who, pretty much all sides agree, has not fully disarmed?
Well, the question is, how much of a threat is Mr. Hussein to the United States? And what are our national priorities? I don't think our national priorities call at this time for the massive use of force in Iraq.
If every Foreign Service officer felt the obligation to resign every time they disagreed with policy, there'd be chaos around the world, wouldn't there?
Well, as I said, my decision was not an easy one to make. It took me a long while to make it, but I finally did make it because I felt I had to speak out about the situation.
What personal price will you pay for this decision?
Well, I don't have a job at the moment, but we will see.
Do you have any sense that there are other members of the Foreign Service who feel as you do and are considering doing what you did?
All I can say, Bill, is that talking with colleagues, I have felt that my views are not my own only. I think that many diplomats, both here and abroad, share my views.
John, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Bill.
John Brown spent 22 years in the Foreign Service. He resigned on Monday.
Environmental laws are a danger to military readiness. That's the view of the Bush administration, which has attached a measure to pending legislation that would give the Defense Department absolute environmental authority over 30 million acres of military land. The measure was defeated last year in Congress, and the military has operated under existing environmental laws. But now the proposal has returned as part of the Defense Department's 2004 budget authorization bill, which will face hearings on Capitol Hill tomorrow. Well, joining us on the line is Michael Jasny. He's senior policy analyst for Natural Resources Defense Council. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Robin. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. You oppose this measure. Why?
Yes, we do. This measure would affect so many of our landmark environmental laws. These are the laws that keep our water and air clean, that protect us from cancer, that conserve our most endangered species. And with one broad swipe, while the country is looking abroad, this administration is trying to roll them back.
As you know, the administration and the military say that they are trying to conserve you and that environmental laws keep soldiers from training in ways that mimic how they would fight. In other words, they can't do shooting at night in some instances because it would disturb rare habitat. And they say they have to do that to get it right.
Well, you know, a couple weeks ago, Christy Todd Whitman, administrator of EPA, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee on this very issue, and she said there isn't a training exercise in the country that's not taking place or being held up because of environmental regulation.
General Keane was talking about his 10th Mountain Division in Afghanistan, and he said that they were able to fight so well with the Afghans because they trained at night, but that under some of the Endangered Species Acts, they would not be allowed to train on several of the military training grounds because of a law that protects a spotted owl.
The Defense Department has been making false claims about limitations on bases for years. We're familiar, for example, running out of Senate California with activities taking place on Camp Pendleton. The Department of Defense has claimed that over 57% of Camp Pendleton is unavailable for training. In fact, only under about 3% of a very large area is under any form of protection under the Endangered Species Act.
Well, and some would want to stick with existing environmental laws that allow for case-by-case exemptions from the law, but the military says they just don't have the time for that. They can't be, you know, going to get a waiver because of a sea lion in the harbor when a ship has to be deployed, for instance.
Well, you know, that's another false statement. There is absolutely nothing in the law that requires the Defense Department to go in under such cases. What these laws protect us from is a sort of thing that the military has been doing for years, contaminating drinking water by improperly disposing of ordnance. This happened in Cape Cod last year, creating toxic waste sites around the country, or causing whales to strand and die on our beaches.
In fact, some reports say that the U.S. military is the biggest polluter in the country.
Yes, that's correct. And they also superintend a great part of this country's natural heritage, over 30 million acres of land and millions of square miles of ocean.
What do you think is going on here, Michael?
Well, I think, unfortunately, that it's another case of this Bush administration undermining our environmental laws by any means necessary. And to ram this bill through Congress at this time and in this way on the defense authorization bill is cynical even by their standards.
Well, of course, again, they would say that their concern is with the public's health and safety, and that's why they're making the request. Michael, we'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Michael Jasny is Senior Policy Analyst for the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Still to come, a history of baking in America with some helpful tips on how best to bake.
And you want freedom fries with that? A North Carolina congressman does. He wants the French out of everything from fries to toast.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Men and women in the military are often called up to serve with very little notice, which brings up many problems, including what to do with pets. After the Gulf War, animal shelters were inundated with cats and dogs, but that isn't happening as troops are called for possible combat in Jacksonville, North Carolina, because of a unique pet foster plan. Joining us on the line is Gail Whipple. She's co-founder of the Carolina Animal Protection Society of Onslow County. Welcome, Gail.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And I know you're located near Camp Lejeune Marine Base, so tell us about your plan to help out deploying pet owners.
Well, at the time, our first call came from a young private in December before he deployed, and he called me on a Sunday evening at 9 o'clock, and he was leaving at 6 o'clock Monday morning.
Right. Well, so what did you decide to do?
Well, I had about two other Marines call, and we had no idea that the dimensions of this crisis were going to be so huge, and I wrote a letter to the editor and pleaded with the people in our community to call us. We needed foster homes. We needed adoption homes for all the dogs and cats that belong to these Marines that were deploying, because many of the wives were going home and they were in situations where they were back home living with families and, you know, they, for one reason or another, they couldn't bring their animals with them.
Mm. Has it been tough for some of them to leave the animals behind?
Yes. Yes. I was with a few of people saying goodbye to their animals, and they're trying to be, and they are very brave. And I'm usually the one that crumbles under the situation. Because, you know, you hate to send a young man or a young woman off to war and the uncertainties of war and them not knowing the fate of their beloved pet.
I'm thinking of Homer's Odyssey and the dog that waited for his beloved owner to come home.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. Well, but the good news is you seem to have had quite a response and good placement for the animals.
We have, and we've had people call saying they would take birds. We've had people call saying we'll take the snakes, we'll take the lizards, we'll take the turtles. So it has been very good.
And can't forget the cats.
Yeah, oh, no, absolutely not. No, the majority are dogs and cats.
Yeah. A lot of people might wonder, why would a soldier, knowing that they might be deployed, get involved with a pet?
You know, that's a question we ask all the time. And, you know, but a lot of these Marines are young Marines. They live off base, and they come home to an empty house. And it's much nicer to have a happy animal greet you than to walk into an empty house. And that's the only thing that we can come up with.
Well, now other families will have that happy animal as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, Gail, thank you.
And the only thing I will ask is please, all of you, keep these men and women in your prayers nightly.
Gail, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Gail Whipple is co-founder of the Carolina Animal Protection Society of Onslow County, North Carolina.
I still got a long way to go.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tonight at 7, On Point with Tom Ashbrook, first-hand reports from the front in waiting, a discussion with war correspondents around the Persian Gulf. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Newman School, a small co-ed college preparatory school in the Back Bay. Applications now being accepted for fall 2003, 617-267-4530. The law firm of Sharon and Lodgen, LLP, over 50 years of experience in transactional practice, business litigation, and related areas of practice, SHERIN.com. And Graham Contracting, working to create cooperative relationships with clients, subcontractors, suppliers, and surrounding communities to streamline home renovation projects, GrahamContracting.com. Visit the public radio store at WBUR.org, where every purchase helps pay for the news. This week, book travel on AirTran Airways, offering low fares to spacious business class cities. Go. There's nothing stopping you. And thanks.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Greg Patent has an odd career trajectory. A zoology professor, he quit the academic world to cook and document the world of food. He's written about apples, cooking in the Old West, and now his new book is out. It tells the story of baking in America, from the first American cookbook in 1796 to the Pillsbury Bake Off. Greg lives in Missoula, Montana, but he joins us in the studio today with the cookbook. Greg, thanks for coming in. This is huge.
It's very big.
How long did it take you to put this together?
This took 4 years.
Well, it seems it. And the entire history of baking, it's a huge book. So let's start at the beginning. Where was the beginning?
The beginning, my beginning, was 1796 with Amelia Simmons. She was an American who wrote the first American cookbook published in America. Before that, we had cookbooks published in Europe that were reprinted here. But hers was the first collection of recipes really documenting American cookery. And her book really represents English recipes that she had translated using American ingredients. And this is why I was so taken by it, that she uses cornmeal in her recipes, whereas in England they would have used oatmeal.
Mm-hmm.
She uses cranberries. She uses pumpkins. And so she actually set the groundwork for all that was to follow.
Right. It was kind of the New World cookbook. And you sprinkle little tidbits throughout along with the recipes that you've gathered over the years. The Parker House rolls. These were invented at the Parker House Hotel right here in Boston.
Actually, they were invented at the Tremont House, which is
That's
a
right.
neighbor of the Parker House by a baker there. But they became famous at the Parker House because many more travelers, businessmen, stayed at the Parker House. The word got out. And so they became known as the Parker House roll.
Right. You sprinkle modern day tips throughout as well. When you test a pound cake for doneness,
mm-hmm.
you do what?
You listen to it.
Because it's going to do what?
Because it'll talk back to you if it's not done. If you put your ear down to the pound cake.
Not in the oven. You must
no,
put it
you
on
take
the counter.
Not in the oven, please. We're not doing the Hansel and Gretel number. You take the cake out of the oven and you put your ear close to it. And if it makes kind of like a slight hissing or sibilant sound, then it's not quite done. But if it's not talking to you, then it's basically saying it is done.
Isn't that something? You've brought in the results of one of the recipes and also some tips for how to work with an ingredient. Tell us about what you've got in front of you.
What I have in front of me are persimmons. And the important point to remember when one's working with persimmons is that they have to be really, really ripe. They have to really feel like they're a sack of mush.
You know, I have to say persimmons have not really been on my radar. Let's describe them for people who didn't know that there's a Native American persimmon. It's this beautiful, what color is that, orange?
And this is the Japanese persimmon. This isn't our Native American one. But it's a beautiful orange color. Mm-hmm. And they are very slithery. They feel very smooth when you just eat them. They're very sweet. Mm-hmm. But they have to be absolutely ripe. If not, they're very puckery and you will never want to eat one again. So you have to be very careful to let them ripen properly. And you simply bring them home, let them sit in a counter for maybe for a few days until they get to be like almost that you feel ready for the compost heap.
Oh boy.
But not. That's when it's ready to be baked with. And then you cut them open, you scoop out the pulp, and for the persimmon walnut bread, you basically make a puree. And let me just show you how to do the puree.
Please.
I like to have the persimmon in the bowl, and I use a pastry blender, you know, with five or six blades. And you just chop. Can you hear that? I mean, it's just, you chop, 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 chop.
It's a lot like a mango in texture, but it's producing a lot of juice, like an orange.
A lot of juice, and then you just flip it over, use the blades.
Now it looks like orange slush.
And then you get a puree. You see, some of it is going to be very smooth, and some of it will be chunky. And I much prefer to do it this way with just a bowl and a pastry blender than, say, put it into a food processor, which will make it way too smooth and may actually make it too watery. Mm. So with just this mechanical breaking up.
Now, we should say, too, because there are people across the country who grow their own persimmons, because you point out they can be grown in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Illinois,
all the way south to Florida and west to eastern Texas.
And when you pick them, you what?
You wait until they fall from the tree.
See,
you don't really pick them because the trees are very tall. And they're small. These are, we're talking about like golf ball size persimmons, the Native American one. And they will have an orangey colored flesh. And when they fall from the tree, that's when they're ripe. Mm. And they will be very soft. And then you would cut them open and scoop the flesh out.
The actual persimmon walnut bread recipe that you have in the book is very simple ones. And we will have that on our website, by the way. But I want to taste it and ask you, while we stay with the idea of fruit and baking, give me a couple of tips. For baking with fruit,
just make sure that the fruit is really, really ripe.
Mm, delicious. This is delicious. It's the walnuts are very present. You're not stingy with the walnuts.
Not stingy with the walnuts.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book is filled with great ideas, and it's got all sorts of tips and things. But give us one tip for making, let's say, the perfect cookie.
I would say, again, make sure your oven is at the correct temperature. Get an oven thermometer, a reliable oven thermometer, and check the temperature of your oven. Cookies bake very quickly.
Yeah.
And if one level of your oven is a bit hotter than another level of your oven, you're going to want to know that, because sometimes cookies can burn on the bottom if the bottom of the oven gets too hot.
See, in our family, we call those the fabulous blackened cookies. It's a tradition.
The charcoal ones, right?
Well, thank you so much. It's just got everything anyone could ever want to know. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Greg Patton's new book is called Baking in America. These days, in some circles, there's just no love lost for La France. France's continuing refusal to stand with the U.S., Britain, and Spain to disarm Iraq by force has led to some harsh feelings, and now that war of words has turned into a food fight. Some lawmakers on Capitol Hill have renamed items on the menu in the four cafeterias that serve the House of Representatives. Today's French fries will be tomorrow's Freedom Fries. Joining us on the line is North Carolina Congressman Walter Jones, who brought this idea to Capitol Hill. Congressman Jones, you guys are serious about this?
Yes, ma'am. Robin, let me say that a constituent of mine who owns a restaurant down in Beaufort about 6 weeks ago took the name French off of his menu and put Freedom Fries. And I was so impressed with what he did that last week we started circulating a letter here on the Hill on the House side, asking the House Administration Committee to join us and in the House restaurants changing the name from French fries to Freedom Fries and also French toast to Freedom Toast. we did this certainly in a lighthearted way, but there's a message here, and that is that we believe that the French really should not be so outspoken against our position. We're the country that lost 3,000 citizens in the year 2001.
We also lost so many Americans in liberating France in World War II.
Absolutely.
And I've been hearing on some talk radio, there were people, I actually heard somebody say that he wanted to go exhume the bodies of the American dead and bring them back. I mean, this has gotten pretty heated. Are you fearful that you might be adding to that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we have made sure that we said that this was done in a lighthearted way, but yet there is a message. The message is we're disappointed in the French leadership. In their position as it relates to Saddam Hussein. And there's a second part to this, Robin, also. This is a gesture of solidarity with the hundreds of thousands of troops who are willing to die to protect our freedom.
Well, you know, the French have been by our side in the past. We have a long history together. They helped us in the American Revolution. They sent us the Statue of Liberty afterwards.
Yeah, but I believe if you started from the day one of this relationship between the French government and the American government up until today, that you would say that we have done more to help the French than they've ever done to help us.
Yeah, well, and you may know that actually in the past the French have worked very hard to keep American words out of their language. I think they even had a ministry head who was in charge of that. But don't you think, I mean, on the Simpsons television show, they went so far as calling the French the cheese-eating surrender monkeys. And the New York...
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but...
Well, it gets worse. The New York Post replaced the picture of the French foreign minister with the head of a weasel on their front page cover story.
I think I did see that, come to think about it. But, Robin, to have the French, who are supposed to be our allies, that have really taken the upper hand to be in opposition, is really very disappointing to a large number of American people.
Well, Congressman, it is a serious issue, as you say,
yes,
but also presents some... Well, what are you going to do, for instance, about the those little sealed packages of French dressing? They're already labeled.
I have moved the ball this far. We're going to let somebody else move the ball further.
Well, Congressman Jones, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Nice talking with you.
You also. Walter Jones, Republican Congressman from North Carolina.
They've even got Groundskeeper Willie teaching French.
Bonjour, you cheese-eating surrender monkeys!
Here and Now is a production of WVUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.